Well, it's great to be here with everybody. I see friends from lots of our different Northwest Sanghas, from Calgary, Salt Spring Island, from Victoria, from south of the border, Bellingham, Red Cedar community, and of course, lots of people from Mountain Rain. Who did I leave out? Where else?
Seattle.
Oh, yeah. Right. White Horse. Right. It's kind of great, everybody from all over. So we were up in Salt Spring Island on Friday. We had a Jukai there. And then we came over on the ferry. We had a very exciting and eventful ferry ride. Those of you who are on the ride know what I'm talking about. And in my mind, you know, all these many sanghas are branching streams of Suzuki Roshi's way. We're all related. We're all also part of the Everyday Zen family of sanghas. I think we share a spirit, we share a heart for the way. So I feel really at home, especially in Sesshin. Being here with all of you, this is my home. I appreciated yesterday when Michael was teaching us that Sesshin means receiving the heart. I thought that was such a beautiful understanding. So good for us. We're lucky. We have almost a week to just sit here to receive our own heart, which, as he said, is the one boundless heart of the world. So we can feel really lucky and really safe and willing to be here with whatever is inside us and all around us, to trust that whatever comes will be okay. And even if it's tough, we have the place to experience it, and it will heal us. And it's not necessary for us to do anything more than just be here, as much as possible, not getting in our own way, and gently bringing ourselves back again and again and again to the breath, to the body, to the present moment of living activity. This is such a marvelous world, to have a body, a breath, a mind. What a blessing. And I also appreciated his reminding us that we're not here alone, that our life is not just our life, that we share our lives with one another, and we share them with our ancestors of the past and our descendants far into the future. These other lives that we think of conventionally, practically as other lives, are actually not other than our own life. They are in us. We live all those lives in our life. And that's why what we do now in our lives matters so much, because it doesn't just matter to us. We have received a precious world, a precious life, and we have to protect it so that we can pass it on in the future. To be alive as a human being, when you think about it, it is such an awesome thing. You know, in this whole cosmos, just these few of us, it's awesome with the capacities we have. And it means we have a tremendous responsibility. Each one of us does. And we're here to prepare ourselves to take this responsibility. As I said in my words in the first night of Sesshin, we are following the Bodhisattva path, a path with great heart and great passion to be of benefit to others. Bodhisattvas practice the six paramitas of giving, ethical conduct, patient forbearance, which Thich Nhat Hanh calls all-inclusiveness, and Suzuki Roshi calls constancy, joyful effort, which Dogen calls continuous practice, meditation, and understanding, prajna paramita, who, as we chant every morning, is lovely and holy, gives light to dispel all fear and distress. And she is our organ of vision, and she has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, because she never forgets. She never strays from the truth of what dharmas are. She sets in motion the wheel of dharma that turns and turns each moment, all day long. So I know this session marks the end, I think, of the practice period here in the Pacific Northwest and Mountain Rain. And we're also having practice period in the Bay Area, Sangha. And when I come home from this session, the next day we'll have the end of our practice period there. We completed our session there. We have our session a little bit around toward the middle, close to the end, rather than at the very end. So we just finished session there. Right, Julia? Wherever I do Sesshin, Julia is sure to be there. It's quite extraordinary, actually. I think if I went to Sesshin and Julia wasn't there, I wouldn't know what to do, you know? Now what do I do? Zazen? What? I don't know what to do. Anyway, we almost didn't have that Sesshin over there, because there were fires raging. Many of our Sangha members were evacuated. Nobody had any power. The whole county was shut down. There were no gas stations, no grocery stores. Dark everywhere. And the Santa Sabina retreat center didn't know whether it was going to be able to accommodate us. And so we actually couldn't start session when we planned to, but we did start a day later. And somehow or other, it was an extremely quiet, peaceful session. Everybody was very peaceful, very focused, very, very, just, we floated through. I know that the theme here for practice period is the Chinese Zen ancestors. And I asked Kate to send me more or less what you were studying, and she sent me the list of teachers that you discussed and the talks that various of the senior members of the community gave. And it was really great. I said, oh, I wish I could have been there to hear all that. and it sounded very thorough, very serious, and I made me feel a little ashamed of my usual slapdash effort to do things. Whoops, what day is it? You know, what religion are we practicing today? So I was a little ashamed and a little embarrassed. So thanks to Kate and Michael and the Mountain Rain community for having such a strong commitment to studying the Dharma so thoroughly. It's pretty inspiring. Our theme for our practice period at home is the six paramitas and the Bodhisattva path. And we are trying to commit ourselves to this great way of life. Because we know that we really need a clear way to navigate through the difficult times we live in. And also, for many of us in our Sangha in the Bay Area, through the rough waters of sickness, old age, and death. It may be awesome being human, but also it's not easy. And if things are a mess in your life, or my life, or our collective lives on earth, it's not your fault, it's not my fault. We can't say it's this person's or that group of persons' fault. This is who we are. This is what we are. This is how we are. We, together, have made this world. And we really, really need a path through it. So we have confidence that the Bodhisattva path is the best way for us. If you read the Indo-Tibetan teachings about the Bodhisattva path, you can be so impressed with how colorful, how extensive, how enthusiastic these teachings are. Full of love and full of, you know, outrageous stuff and abstruse Buddhist philosophy. And it is so incredible to me and so beautiful, so wonderful that our Chinese Zen ancestors could find a way to bring these teachings and this joyful and compassionate spirit right down to earth, to make it simple and concrete, and even have a little sense of humor about it. To see that, as we also learned yesterday, just to cut wood and carry water is the supreme miracle, the magic that will save all sentient beings. And in this way, the Bodhisattva path is so inspiring, so empowering. We know what to do. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't know what's going to happen to you or me or our friends. And we're not in control of that. The net of causality is infinitely large, and no computer model can even begin to capture it, much less our own feeble abilities to predict the future. But one thing we do know for sure, that good is good, and that good produces good. So even if we don't know what will happen, we do know that we can do good, and we can get good at doing good, and we could keep on doing good, and that this activity will matter somehow, even though we don't know precisely how. And then we can live our lives together with confidence. So as I was saying also the other night, we are practicing the six paramitas. But today I'm thinking about one of them, how great it is in Sesshin especially to practice virya paramita, the paramita of strength, joyful and continuous effort. And Sesshin is really wonderful for practicing this and developing this in ourselves. Because in Sesshin, there's little choice but to keep on going, right? No other way. You have to do it. Moment after moment, you know exactly what to do. Might not be what you would like to do at that moment. It doesn't matter, though. It really doesn't matter. I mean, that's the beauty of it. It doesn't matter what you would like to do. You know what to do, moment after moment. And the schedule, and the spirit of the Sesshin, and the Dharma brothers and sisters next to you help you along. I think everybody here knows what a colossal drag it is to resist in Sesshin, whether it's your own body you're resisting or the schedule you're resisting. This is a miserable experience, right? Imagine if somebody plopped you down here and you didn't want to do this. This is not was not your idea of a good time, and you had to do this. This would be like the most miserable experience anybody could have. Thinking that there was an alternative would make you so unhappy. But we know there's no alternative. We just go on practicing continuous effort, giving ourselves to our activity, whatever activity happens to be next on the schedule, is joyful, right? When we just give ourselves to it, it couldn't be a better. Smooth, joyful, continuous effort that carries us along from beginning to end, and that makes each one of us more than ourselves. This is the only way to do Sesshin. And it really is the best way to live your life. So if we can learn how to practice this in Sesshin, we can also learn how to practice it in our whole life. And that's an immense thing, really, to live that way. So in my book, The World Could Be Otherwise, I have a chapter on Virya Paramita. And I try to think of all the different aspects of Virya Paramita. And when you think about Virya Paramita and what it involves, there's so much to it. It's endless, you know, endless. So I try to think of all the different aspects of our lives that were involved. And I thought of several, and I wrote about them. But I want to read a little bit this morning about two of them, which I think have already come up in our minds and are really important to us in Sesshin: vowing and hope. Bodhisattvas are defined by their vows. If you read Mahayana Sutras, some of them have pages after pages after pages after pages of vows. This bodhisattva has these vows, and this one has these vows, and on. Extravagant, outrageous vows. The practical mind is very careful about vows. One should only vow what one feels one can realistically accomplish in a doable time frame. Otherwise, you would have welched on your promise. And this makes sense, you know, in an ordinary vision for our lives. But it is way too limiting for the outrageously expansive life of a bodhisattva. For bodhisattvas, a vow is not the same as a promise to accomplish something so that you can go on then to make another promise to accomplish something else later. For bodhisattvas, a vow is an expression of deep intention and vision, a horizon toward which you will journey forever. We know the vows we take at the end of every Dharma talk, these outrageous vows to save an infinite number of beings and so on. To me, it's funny, you know, people walk into the Zen Center for the first time and then somebody tells them to chant this and they chant it. I wonder what they're thinking. It's crazy. Right? These vows are clearly not meant to be promises that we're going to keep. You will not save an infinite number of beings in a finite lifetime. That's clear. And yet it makes sense to chant these vows with our heart focused on them because they express our firm commitment to a path and a way of life. To practice a vow, that's what we do. We practice a vow. We don't make a vow or take a vow. We practice a vow. It means we embrace it in a heartfelt and serious way. And we understand that even though we embrace it, we're not as committed to it as we hope to be in the future. Right now, we're not. We hope our commitment will grow over time. Maybe the whole of spiritual practice is nothing other than vowing. If I really come to the place where I completely mean it, when I say, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them, I'm a different person, right? I'm someone who's no longer capable of being a victim of my own confusion and selfish attachment, if I really mean it when I say that vow. I was one who stumbled into the Zen Center and chanted those vows and thought, what? And I had no idea what I was saying. I even took the Bodhisattva precepts without really knowing what I was doing. But as time went by, I got more serious about this. And after a while, it took a long time, you know, I could see, okay, I am really trying to do this. I am trying to go beyond my selfishness. Maybe I'm not getting that far, but I'm definitely trying to do this. This is what I'm doing. As you know, we have the wonderful tradition, as many of you have practiced, receiving the 16 Bodhisattva precepts and becoming an official person on the Bodhisattva path. When you do that, it's a kind of like surgery, soul surgery. You're going in there with a very delicate scalpel and you're removing the self-centeredness which is built into us biologically. You're taking that out and you're sticking in there the Bodhisattva vows instead. You used to be a normal person who naturally considers, as all normal people do, care and protection of self and close others as the most important thing. But now, after this surgery, you are an extraordinary person whose concern is to reduce self-centeredness and establish love and concern for others without exception as your commitment in life. Of course, all of us who have gone through this can't help but notice after it's over, whoops, I'm still the same as I was before. Actually, if I'm going to be honest about it, and I'm impressed, you know, with how much this ceremony means to people. I mean, it's the weird thing. I think you, all of you, will tell me that probably that going through this ceremony changes your life completely. And not at all. It's weird. But you would say that, you know, like, this, I'm completely different ever since then, and nothing at all has changed. It's weird, but that's the truth. Because, obviously, you don't go through a ceremony and then you no longer have any self-centeredness. It's gone. No, it's not gone. No, it's not gone. It remains, just as it was before. The difference is that now you know self-centeredness for what it is. And you are clear, at least most of the time, that your commitment is to see through self-centeredness because you know that it's painful. It doesn't really serve you. So rather than affirming and defending and bolstering yourself, you now see that the best thing that you can do for yourself and for everyone else is to admit that just like everyone else, you are a slave to self, but that your effort for a whole lifetime is to free yourself from this bondage. So the vow really changes your priorities and your vision for your life, and it really does set you forth on a path. Hope. If you go to a lot of Buddhist places, they'll tell you hope is un-Buddhist. Have you noticed? Have you heard this? Because Buddhism emphasizes, you know, being present, living in the present, and hope is always about the future. So we don't hope. Hope is not Buddhist. Well, there's a good reason why Buddhists say that. There's truth to it. Bodhisattvas probably don't hope for something. In the future should take place in a certain way that we would like. Probably bodhisattvas are too smart to fall for that trap. But this does not mean that bodhisattvas are not hopeful. Of course they are. In times of great stress or challenge, it is important that bodhisattvas, for their own sake, and for the sake of those around them, remain genuinely hopeful. Now, being hopeful doesn't mean being foolish. When it's pretty clear that bad things are going to happen, bodhisattvas do not pretend that this is not the case. But bodhisattva hopefulness does not depend on pleasant things happening or insist on cheery outcomes. true hope exists even when terrible things actually do happen. Bodhisattva hope arises naturally out of the practice of joyful continuous effort. There's nothing more hopeful than seshin, even though we're not hoping for anything. We're just doing it. And yet there's a buoyant spirit to it. Because bodhisattva hope does not depend on what happens next. It's not about the future. It's about the nature of being itself. Think about it. If there's a present moment, a present living moment, it must include within it a potential future moment. We talk about the present moment as if it weren't the future, but the future is right here in every present living moment, just as the past is right here now in every present living moment. If you look for the present moment, there's no present moment. Of course not. As long as we are alive, every present moment includes within it a future moment. Even if I'm 5 minutes away from my death, in this one moment of my life, there is a future. As soon as that's no longer the case, I am no longer a living being. Literally, life is time, is hope. So every moment contains a future moment, and every future is unknown and unknowable. That's why we call it the future. You can't predict the future. Something good could happen, even though it seems completely unlikely, you never know. Something bad could also happen. But the point is, nobody knows what's going to happen next or how whatever happens is going to feel or what unexpected consequences will flow from that which occurs. And that's how life is. Bodhisattvas deeply feel this truth. And so they're always hopeful for the next moment of life. Even if it does bring catastrophe, meeting that catastrophe with joyful effort is possible. And when you meet a moment in this way, even if it happens to be your last moment, it will be noble, decisive, and beautiful. So this is the bodhisattva practice of Viryaparamita, continuous, joyful effort to go on practicing, vowing, and with hope. If we say joyful effort, it might be a little misleading. We think of joy as a happy face and a cheerful attitude. And sometimes, maybe a lot of the time, we might feel that way when we practice. But sometimes, the practice of Viryaparamita might appear as discouragement, even despair. Because bodhisattvas are human beings. That's their whole point, is they share life completely with all human beings. We're human beings. So we feel and are happy to feel whatever human beings feel. And this is their path. This is their commitment, to be with and for human beings, to feel all that humans feel, including the suffering. So yeah, sometimes in our path of Viryaparamita, we feel grief. I think a lot we feel grief. We feel despair. Sometimes The practice of Virya Paramita might look like a person dissolving into tears for an entire day of session. When conditions for such feelings are present, we are willing to feel them. Losing someone, we grieve. Frightened about the future, we can be overcome with feelings of desolation. Feeling these things doesn't mean we're taking a break from our bodhisattva path. It doesn't mean we're not practicing Virya Paramita. But as we learn from Sesshin, we might feel such a thing very intensely, and it would feel in the moment of feeling it like it's going to go on forever, and then boom, the bell rings, and then we're going to lunch, and pretty soon we're happily tasting our food, and it's all gone. Or the bell rings, and it's time to walk outside, and the big sky, and the quiet lake, and the silent trees somehow absorb the feeling completely, so that it's everywhere, it's not just in us. And we go on with our practice, which always carries us forward. And as we practice year after year, we have enormous confidence in this. We're not scared of anything that we would feel. We know practice carries us forward. So we're okay with feeling grief or desolation. We got enough space inside of us to feel all that. That's okay. We know that's part of our being human. Sometimes it's like that, right? Life is full of trouble. It happens. Why not to us? Sure. And we go on. So I'll read you something else. This is a life full of continuous practice, full of Virya Paramita. So I'm reading to you from this book, A White Tea Bowl, 100 Haiku from 100 Years of Life. Maybe you know this book, right? Mm-hmm. Because Kate translated these haiku of Mitsu Suzuki, but I want to read to you first just her life. This is a life of continuous practice, an exemplary life. So Mitsu Suzuki was 100 years old on April 23rd, 2014. And she died in 2016. Spanning the changes and disasters of one of the most spectacular centuries in history. A century in which East and West have been struggling to meet and understand one another. The winds of time have blown her back and forth across the ocean. Beneath her sweetness, you sense the stoic toughness she possesses, not so much because she was raised to it, but because it was required of her. She was born in Shizuoka City in 1914, at the height of Japanese militarism and ambition in Asia and throughout the world. Japanese were determined to outdo the West. Her mother died when she was 11, leaving her as the woman of the household. At 19, dissatisfied with the conventionality and coldness that she found in Japanese Buddhism, she converted to Christianity. Did you know that? Yeah, she was a Christian. She was a member of the local Methodist church. In 1936, at 22, she married Masaharu Matsuno, a naval pilot. And when war broke out in 1937 between China and Japan, Masaharu went off, and Mitsu at that time was 7 months pregnant, and he was killed a couple weeks after seeing the first photographs of his daughter. After the war, she trained as a school teacher, and when her daughter was three and old enough to be in childcare, she began teaching at a local kindergarten. And when the Pacific War began, the war that we call World War II, and American pilots began flying their interminable and devastating raids all over Japan, Mitsu and other teachers would take their students into bunkers each and every day as bombs rained down on their cities. On the night of June 16th, 1945, 3 months before Japan surrendered and the war ended, the entire city of Shizuoka was burned to the ground. We remember a month or two later, August 6th, when the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. But I think it was probably more impressive to us than it was to them in Japan, because they had seen so much bombing already that this was another horrible bombing. Maybe worse, maybe some nuclear thing, but anyway, when your city's on fire, who cares, you know, what the weapon is exactly. So, like every other Japanese person in her generation, she believed, and it wasn't just a belief, she had experience of this, that Americans were people who wanted to kill her and everybody else who was Japanese. Therefore, how strange, how marvelous, and probably how disturbing that only 16 years later she found herself living in the United States full time, the new wife of a Soto Zen priest stationed in San Francisco. She would never could have imagined such a thing. After the war, all the schools in Japan were in awful shape. There were no schools, basically, because their facilities had been destroyed. So all over Japan, civic leaders were trying to take care of this problem as fast as they could. And in Yaizu, a little fishing town not far from Shizuoka City, Suzuki Shunryu, Suzuki Roshi, was keen to reopen the historically important kindergarten that was attached to his temple, Rinso-in. And a friend of his told him about this great kindergarten teacher down the street, down the next town, Mitsu, her name wasn't Suzuki at the time. And he was determined to hire this great teacher for his school. He was an ambitious guy. He was going to get a really good teacher for his school. So he went to recruit her, but she said, "No, I can't leave Shizuoka. And besides, you have a Buddhist kindergarten, and I'm Christian, so how could I work for your school?" But Suzuki Roshi was a persistent guy, and he kept popping up all the time. Hey, he'd show up at her school. "Hey, how are you? I'm here again. You still think you might want to come to Rinso-in? I just look, just to look at it. You don't have to make any commitments. Just take a look and see what the school's like." No, I can't do it. Finally, he broke down her resistance, and she came for a visit. And that was enough. "I'll take the job." "But what about the Christian problem?" "Well, at least you have some religion," he said to her. So he it was right attached to the temple, you know, and so he would visit every day at the school, and he would, you know, chant with the children and give them Buddhist lessons. And he and Mitsu became very close friends and colleagues working with the children. Two strong, opinionated, charismatic people. Both of them had a very lively sense of humor. And they were colleagues and friends. And then a terrible tragedy happened in the Suzuki family. Shunryu was married and had three young children. His wife was murdered by a mentally ill Soto Zen priest who Suzuki had allowed to stay in the temple when he wasn't there. And this priest murdered his wife. You could wonder, like, why did you do that? But never mind, he did. Anyway, he was left now with three young children, and he needed a wife. So the Rinso Inn community discussed this matter, including his mother-in-law, and they all agreed that there was only one person who could be his wife. So naturally they were married. In the fall of 1958, he was 54, she was 44. Less than a year later, he was invited to become abbot for a short term at Sokoji Temple in San Francisco, fulfilling his lifetime dream. He had been preparing himself for this his whole life, of going to America to teach Zen to Westerners, even though these were Japanese Americans that he was going to be with, but he saw it as an opportunity to reach out to other Westerners. So he went, and his short-term appointments kept being renewed, and the longer he stayed in America, the more young Western students came to practice with him, and they wanted to practice Zazen, unlike the parishioners of Sokoji, who just wanted memorial services and observances. They never dreamed of Zazen, but the Western students didn't know any better. So they all thought that they could do Zazen and get enlightened. You know, they were naive. They didn't know. So after a number of years of renewed appointments, Suzuki Roshi eventually turned over Rinso Inn to his son Hoitsu, who's still the abbot of Rinso Inn. And he also resigned his post at Sokoji and threw in his lot with these crazy Western students, an extremely risky thing for him to have done. But he did. And she came, as I said, in 1961 and remained for 32 years. She didn't go home to stay until 1994, 23 years after Suzuki Roshi's death. And during those years, she became, by the account of many American students who studied tea with her, and yes, also in her own informal way, Zen with her, she had become an accomplished and much-loved spiritual master who inspired affection and respect and was a second mother to many, many people. In her quiet, yet very forceful way, she expressed and embodied Zen spirit and continuity with the founder. And she continued to live in the small apartment where they had lived together in the temple building. She taught tea, she cooked, she cleaned, she tended altars, she received guests. She was an anchor for the community. As long as Oksan remained, as long as she went on day by day quietly expressing her life in engagement and sympathy with the community, things were going to be okay. Suzuki Roshi was only 67 when he died, and he died too soon for us. Even the most developed students that he left behind were very young and barely had practiced Zen. They were full of idealism and moxie and, you know, Zen theory. And they were good students and very astute, but they could not possibly have enough maturity. They had not lived through the sorts of challenges that Oksan and her husband had experienced during their years in Japan. And they had no basis for appreciating Zen as the religion that it actually is. A powerful consolation and source of strength in times of suffering and instability. They didn't know anything about that. But Oksan's presence expressed this strength and depth during the long, rocky years of Zen Center's coming of age. And when she was confident that that work was done, and the maturity of the center through many hard times was established, it was time to go home. So more than anything else, what Oksan taught in America was what Japan lacked after the war, and maybe still lacks, confidence and depth. Confidence and in the depth of the Japanese way as formed by that culture's long encounter with the Buddhist teachings. It's very interesting to me that although, like all good Japanese girls, she had studied tea as a young girl, it wasn't until she came to America that she began to be serious about it. And her practice of writing haiku, which this book is all about, also began in America during the time when Suzuki Roshi first fell ill. How strange that the powerful expression of her life, her essential Japaneseness, that elusive and also ineffable feeling that unites tragedy, toughness, delicacy, beauty, and simplicity, was oddly never fully expressed in her until it came out in America, possibly as a way of coping with the strangeness or maybe the pain of living for so many years among the people who had burned her country nearly to the ground. Incomprehensible people, in many ways completely oblivious to who she was and what she had lived through, and who at the same time perhaps understood and appreciated her more than anyone ever had. It's funny, huh? That only in America did Nitsu Suzuki find and express her Japanese heart. Here's one of her haiku. I bow to my ballpoint pen and throw it out. Year's end. And I'm going to close with a few more haiku. So beautiful. Kate did such a great job. Valley Temple bell with the last ring, a new century. Valley Temple bell with the last ring, a new century. In the abbot's quarters, compassion, the word compassion, on a large scroll. Winter sunlight. Over and over through Dharma talk and Zazen. Crashing thunder. a day for digging bamboo shoots. Even the abbot is here. Jizo Bodhisattva, protector against dementia. Fringed iris. You'll never look at a fringed iris again in the same way, right? isn't that right? Fringed iris. I'm going to get some fringed iris planted in my garden for sure. Great temple hall. I ladle sweet tea over baby Buddha. Simple Dharma bliss. Newly arrived monks, many faces, fresh spring breeze, deep in the temple, a thousand-armed kanon, coolness of green leaves. What a wonderful person, and what a wonderful life. We got to visit her when we were in Japan a number of years ago. It was really great to see her again. So, in just the way that her life was so important to so many people, changed so many lives, your life must be the same. Whatever suffering you will know in your life, you have to take that suffering and change it into continuous practice, just as she did, so that you also can be a blessing for the world. This is our path. This is our way. Will you do it? 100% sure. 100%. You'll do it. Thank you.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true